to do two more things, and I think you'll begin to get some pictures as we do this. I want you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 2. Now, this was the first vision that God gave to Daniel. In Daniel chapter 2, you remember King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, woke up, called his wise men, said, I want to know the interpretation. They said, okay. He said, I'll give the man who gives me this half of my kingdom. They said, fine. What is the dream? And he said, that's the rub. I've forgotten the dream. So you must give me both the dream and the interpretation. And they said, that's a little tough. And he said, it better not be too tough, or you'll all be dead by tomorrow morning. God gave Daniel this picture. And here's the interpretation of it in the second chapter of Daniel, verses 31 through 45. He said, King, what you saw was a great image, and it was an excellent vision, but it was a terrible image. The head was of gold, the breast and arms were silver, the belly and thighs of brass, the legs of iron, but his feet were part of iron and part of clay. What do you know about part of iron and part of clay? Mix. They're mix. And thou sawest until a stone was cut out from hands which smote the image upon his feet, that were of iron and clay, and broken to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold, broken to pieces together, and it became chaff as in its summer threshing forth, and the wind carried it forth. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now if we just stopped there, it would be dead. But Daniel said, this is the dream. Now I'm going to tell you the interpretation. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. For the Lord God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And whithersoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thy hand, and thou hast been a ruler. And after thee, look at verse 38. How does verse 38 end? Thou art the head of gold. Now, do we have to worry about the interpretation of that? I hope not. There's enough things that God isn't that specific about. Let's don't worry about the things he tells us, all right? After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and a third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and a fourth kingdom, like iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces, so be it all things, but the iron that breaketh all these shall break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of the potter's frame, part of iron, that kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest iron mixed with mortar clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou saw iron mixed with mortar clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, and they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. In the days of the king, God of heavens, which shall be destroyed, the kingdom shall not be left, etc., 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 etc. Thou hast seen the stone cut out of heaven, and so forth, and so forth, and so on. Now let's just stop 5 seconds and look at this. If Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, was the head of gold, then he said, a kingdom will come after you, that is, very specific, a breast and arms of silver. What would that have been? What was the next kingdom after Babylon? Media, Persian, and Empire. Exactly. And then you have a belly and thighs that are made of brass. Greek. Alexandrian Empire. Incidentally, these symbols are so perfect. They are so perfect, even as to the symbolism that those empires subsequently changed. And legs of iron. Who's the symbol of the Roman? Iron, teeth of iron. Okay? But his feet would be part of iron and part of clay. The Roman Empire divided the kingdom between the Eastern and the Western Empire. You remember that from the history books, don't you? They had two separate empires. They divided. Alright? And the feet would be a mixture of these things. Part of clay, which is democracy, democratic ideas. Part of the iron, which is the concept of imperial rule. Now, we've got to take another step, friends. Let's go to the 7th chapter. Daniel, still in Daniel. Now in the 7th chapter, there's another interesting verse. Chapter 7, verse 17, Daniel answered and said unto the king, let thy gifts be to thee. That's the wrong chapter. Okay. Well, this whole chapter, plenty to read. This is the chapter of the horns. Let's go to the first chapter, this first part of the 7th chapter. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, a dream and visions of Daniel, that he had visions of his head upon the bed. And he wrote the matter, and Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strode upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up. Now look at this. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted from the earth, and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Another beast, second like, was to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said, arise and devour much flesh. And behold, another was like to a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. And this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and extremely, and strong extremely. It had iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet thereof, and it was diverse from the beasts that were before it, and it had... How strange. 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them a little horn, before whom they were three of the first horns, plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like as the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, what are we basically seeing in these Daniel passages? A prophetic viewpoint of world powers, ending with the Roman Empire. Now let me just tell you this, as a historian, I promise you this is true. There has never been a world power since the Roman power, and every other nation has tried to be like it. You've heard phrases like the Holy Roman Empire, for example. What was the Holy Roman Empire? It was an effort to pull together certain states. What was Napoleon's dream? Anybody know what his dream was? To rebuild the Roman Empire. What was Hitler's dream? Does anybody know why Hitler struck first south and made an allegiance with Mussolini? Study World War II. What was Hitler's dream? The Roman Empire. It's been the dream of every military leader from time immemorial. And please know this, there's never been in the history of the world a millennium of peace, except the so-called Pax Romana, which was the millennium of peace, the 1,000 years of peace. It was really 900 years, and it wasn't peace, it was dominion, but at least it was almost 1,000 years of a single world power, and that was Rome. Now, when you see this, first of all, you will see in Revelation chapter 13, notice, leopard, bear, lion, and iron again. Exactly the same concepts that are mentioned before. We have Babylonian Empire, Medo-Persian Empire, Greek Empire, Roman Empire. These are the four empires that we deal with. But here we have another image, and that is that one of those empires is raised again. You see, one of the heads is healed, and the whole earth wonders after this head being healed. Again, going backwards in time in world powers, starting with Assyrian, Egyptian, Babylonian, and so forth, we come up with the full number that is being talked of here. Remember that in Nebuchadnezzar's vision, we were starting mid the story, and so the vision concerned him as the head of gold in beginning. Yes, I think the seven, as most commentators see them, are Assyrian, Egyptian first, Assyrian, then Babylonian, then Medo-Persian, and then Greek, and then Roman. Is that seven? Have I missed one? That's six.
Yeah, that's what always happens.
Oh, okay. That's always happened. I'm recalling this just off the top of my head because I didn't look that up tonight. I will check that out. There's obviously one power I'm missing somewhere. They always name six instead of seven. The significance of that, and a lot of people don't believe that's the way, that is what is being talked about here. But there's some explanation for this particular beast. As we see him coming forth, he is a combination. This is the best image I can give you. He is a combination of these imperial world power concepts that have been inculcated in world powers prior to this time. He is, however, and again, if this is what it means, one of these, he is a representation of coming from one of these former world powers being healed. And this is where the whole concept comes of the so-called revived Roman Empire. Now, it does not come just from this. And obviously, here again, friends, here is a point that I can only point to, as our fathers had to point to the fact that these witnesses could be seen all over the world when they laid on the streets for 3.5 days. When our fathers preached that before the days of radio, let alone of television, they had to have a rare sense of faith that God had said it was going to happen. Now it's not hard for us to believe it at all. Satellite television makes it possible every day for this kind of thing to happen. I must say the same about this. It is very evident to me. Now, of course, many Bible teachers who take a symbolic interpretation of Rome or a historic view of Rome say this was being written during a time when Rome was persecuting the church and so forth and so on, and they take very present, present as to that time, historical happenings. I don't believe that. But what I do see, and what I think you will see as you read here, is the impetus over and over again comes to Rome. Seven mountains upon which this woman sits, we are told in the chapter we read, in Revelations chapter 17. The seven hills of Rome are a worldwide symbol. The connection of the nation having died and being raised again. And the connection, definitely, Daniel saw that those legs of iron had produced feet which were a mixture of clay and iron, which in turn had a ten-toed kingdom. And that's what he begins to express. So that the final manifestation of this imperialism is a ten-toed kingdom, which is a mixture of iron and clay. And it is against that kingdom that the rock that is hewn out comes against the feet and destroys that image, and the entire image is ground to powder. And what happens? The rock becomes a mountain and fills the whole earth. Well, that picture is easy for us. Certainly the picture, in fact, Jesus made the same expression. The rock that is hewn out by God, that is cast against this whole concept of imperialism, this whole political system to control man, and of course grinds it to powder, and then that rock becomes, the whole earth is filled, and the whole book is filled with promises of Jesus and his manifestation filling the earth, of course, when it becomes the kingdom of our God and of his Christ. Now this beast, then, is described in terms of power, in terms of authority. The seventh kingdom, that's the reason why. The seventh kingdom is the future one. There's the answer. I was wondering myself what I was trying to do here, and that I knew that that there was an answer to that. So that the seventh kingdom is the one that is yet future tense and is described in the other chapter as being this ten-horned or ten kingdom. Now let me stop a moment, and I'm more interested now with giving you pictures because we don't have time to get into this verse by verse, but I want you to see because you're reading a lot. Some people say, where does the idea come about the common market? How does that fit in? Well, again, the concept is, and I'm not saying this is true or not true, but the concept is that the nations of the common market basically fulfill the pattern of the Roman Empire, and some have been in and out, and it changes on a daily basis. But there are two things that seem very interesting about that common market, and I would suggest simply that you look into this, and I'm very anxious. I have been asked, incidentally, to write a series for, in fact, to write the long overdue and important series on Christian maturity for the International Correspondence Institute, which will be immediately translated into 55 nations, 55 languages of the world. And if I do this, I will be in Brussels for a period of time writing, and I'm very anxious to get to Brussels to confirm for myself some things that have been said. But I am told by people who have spent months, Willard Cantle on a case in point, has literally spent months in Brussels examining the future world monetary system that is now ready to be launched from Brussels. And Willard Cantillon says, contrary to what everybody says, that this is just a trade agreement among nations, that the actual contracts of unity, of actual, governmental unity, are already drawn and prepared. Now, you know that it's already being discussed. You know, for example, that if you read anything in the common market, you know they're already talking about the fact that the country's borders are the things that prevent the common market from working. That there needs to be a blotting out of the borders so that you have import and export. Even though they have a cooperative relationship, it needs to be blotted out. And I read an article 2 weeks ago in our own, in the San Francisco Chronicle, that said the only answer was a monetary system that would be the same throughout all of the common market nations. Now, again, none of us need to speculate here. None of us need to say this is that or that is this. All you need to see is pictures. I don't understand this entirely. I do understand why some Bible scholars have laughed at this for years, that the Roman Empire would ever be revived. But I can tell you this. There has never been a historical era since the Roman Empire that there has not been someone on the earth committed to restoring it. It has been a continuing, call it myth or whatever, it has been a continuing desire in men's hearts to restore that. And incidentally, it has already been mentioned with great possibilities that Rome, rather than Brussels, ought to be the heart of that coming world system. Well, it's, again, these are pictures, aren't they? These are pictures written 2,000 years ago, written by a man who knew nothing about modern warfare, and yet as we describe the locusts in battle, who have the power to sting in their tails, who have faces of man, perfect picture of the small helicopters used in wars, using the best descriptions he could, in his own words, to describe what he saw coming. And so it is with this. Unto this beast was given power to war. We've already talked about this. And now let's begin with the latter portion of this picture that we see in the 11th verse of the 13th chapter. And we'll just take this through and then we'll take our break. And then we'll have a very short session. We'll be over at 9 as we've tried to stay true to that. I saw another beast coming out of the earth. Now is the second member of this Trinity exposed. This beast comes out of the earth. He has two horns like unto a lamb, but he spake like a dragon. What a contrast. And he exerciseth the authority of the first beast in his sight, or before him. He maketh the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose death stroke was healed. And he doeth great signs. He should make fire to come out of heaven and upon earth and in the sight of men. What's that sign?
Lying wonder.
Yeah, it's a lying wonder, but Whoever made fire to come out of heaven? Of course. Elijah is the only one who ever prayed fire out of heaven. What has the Jew always looked for before the Messiah? Elijah. So who must come in order that this satanic deception would be complete? Now look what else he does. He deceives them that dwell on the earth by reason of the signs which was given unto him to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that should dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast who had the stroke in his head, the stroke of the sword, and lived. And it was given unto him to give breath to it. To what? To the image. He gave breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast should speak and cause as many as should not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causeth the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free and the bond that there be given unto them a mark on their right hand and upon their forehead, that no man should be able to buy or sell, save he that hath the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now naturally, this is a passage that's been given a great deal of attention. Who is this we're talking about? Not the beast, not the first beast, not the Antichrist, but the false prophet. This one who draws great attention to the Antichrist, who confirms the Antichrist, who makes the Antichrist be worshipped. And again, here is this whole concept of a satanic trinity being constructed. Israel is awaiting a Messiah, so Satan puts forth the Antichrist. Israel awaits a prophet. It had been announced by Moses. Here comes the prophet deceiving with the very miraculous signs that would identify him as being Elijah, and thereby the forerunner of the Christ. Now this passage that we spend so much time about, what is this mark on the forehead and on the right hand? Well, again, first of all, before we get into a lot of technicality, let's understand what it's a type of. It is a type of the phylacteries which God commanded his people to wear. It is a mark of identification involved in worship. And the economic factor is only a follow-up to that. But because the Antichrist controls the political structure, if the mark has not been accepted or received, then they are not able to buy or to sell or to do business in any manner. Now, I want you to notice the original Greek on this, where it says, the mark, it was given, that there be given them a mark on the right hand or upon their forehead. Because the Greek says, it was caused that they should give themselves a mark. And this is interesting because this is not what we generally hear when the Antichrist concept is talked about. The picture here is one in which you see masses of people pressing forward in a religious hysteria and branding themselves or cutting themselves in some way to establish this mark, eagerly pursuing their identity with this beast. It's a fantastic picture, whatever your interpretation, in terms of its involvement. It is interesting, and I know this now to be true because in major American cities it's already being done. And that is, the whole system of our economic world is being transferred to a pure number system. And I have papers that, in fact, I cut a paper about 2 years ago. Again, it was out of the Chronicle. It was a very interesting article because it suggested, the discussion was already going on, the problem was what number will we assign to the people, and the suggestion was that what would be more natural than that the one number that every person would have would be his Social Security number, which everybody has. Now, here's what the system is based on. Whereas right now, those of you sitting in the seat, you've got, some of you have a MasterCard, some of you have a Bank America card, some of you have an American Express card, many of you have a bank account in the Bank of America, maybe a savings account and some savings alone, and in each of these places, you are a different number. And this is very confusing for the government that would like to keep tabs on you. And it's very confusing also in other ways. Since Social Security numbers are totally unrepeatable, then in the mass of communication, it would be possible through your Social Security number to automatically know in a split second of time what the exact standing of your bank accounts, your savings, your credit, everything in 30 seconds could be known. And I personally had this experience in a large American city where they are now using this system. And it's an electronic computer system in which you, in this case, they are already using it. They were using it in terms of credit cards. And she took my card and put it on a computer, a piece of photographic computer equipment. And in 30 seconds, she had back a total readout: who I was, where I lived, what my wife's name was, what the past month's account in that particular credit card was. And it was there, totally, in 30 seconds, and this was a city 3,000 miles from my home. She had every bit of experience, every bit of knowledge on me possible. Now I know Willard Catalan has proven that one of the systems that's being considered very strongly in Brussels is a system in which a use of a numbering system that would be identifiable only under electronic equipment, so that a number that would be implanted, for example, on your hand or somewhere else on some visible part of your body, so that all would be necessary for you to do, so that nobody could use your card. It would be impossible for credit cards to be lost. It would be impossible for checks to be countersigned. It would be impossible to steal money because there'd be no money to steal. All you would do is pass your hand under the electronic machine that would read that particular number, say the Social Security number, and immediately the total credit standing of your entire life would be revealed in 30 seconds to the person there. Because in just that process of time, in 30 seconds, the entire readout of everything that you bought and sold, own, possess, have borrowed, would all be revealed. And that system is already not only under consideration, but being designed. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment that's what it's going to be. If Jesus tarries in the next 2 or 3 years, there may be something more phenomenal than that. I am just trying to say that there are now. In fact, do you think it's coincidental? Do you know that how many of you have been listening, and I have heard it and just laughed kind of satirically at what I'm hearing? Have you not heard the whole new trend now in banks, in their advertising, which is, let us write your checks? In other words, what you do is your employer makes a direct deposit to your bank. You never see it. And every second Saturday, the money's deposited in the bank. You have given a bank the amount of what your payments are, your house payment and everything else. They automatically pay those accounts. And of course, not one piece of paper is written. Do you understand this? And do you know why it's happening? Do you realize that we are running out of storage room for the process of banking, what it takes to keep the records and have any, even using microfilm? Microfilm hasn't really solved the issue either. This eliminates paper altogether. They don't write a check to your housing. They simply transfer electronically the fact that X dollars on a paper figure is being transferred from the bank to the other bank where the loan is, or to the savings and loan or whatever. No paper exchanges, no paper involvement at all. And you don't see your money. In fact, there isn't any money. And I think most of you know that in the last depression under Nixon and in the first era, for the first time publicly, we were told about paper money. Up till that time, paper money has always been a real... Now, I'm not talking about paper money like the dollar bills we have made out of paper. I'm talking about paper money, meaning it doesn't exist. There's no gold or silver or anything else to support it. It is simply a monetary figure arrived at by world monetary powers and assigned to a nation. You have $160 billion worth of credit. Purely paper figure assigned by world economic powers. Now, these things are already like in the making. Now, one other thing before we break, and I'm going to say this very specifically to you, just so that, please don't believe the fallacy that our world is run by political powers. That's a fallacy. The contemporary world is governed by economic powers. And we know now, more than we've ever known before, and it is daily becoming more and more evident, that huge multinational corporations really control the essence of what happens. Not a political man sitting on a presidency or a kingdom or whatever his name happens to be. For the world powers, and I know E.K. Harris and I have talked about this several times, most of these world, these multinational economic people are awe-national. Do you know what I mean by that? They don't have a nationality. They're not Americans or Russians or South Americans. They are purely what they are, controllers of world economics. And of course, do you see, have you enough perception to see, in the last few months, my friends, I am not prophetically trying to tell you that the oil crisis is this, or that the drought is that, or the famine is this or that, but I do want to say this, you will have to be blind in both eyes and deaf in both ears if you have not at least been able to see through these two crises how quickly the world can be brought to its knees. In a second. In a moment's time. Now I have a question to ask you before we break. How many of you believe if there are no water in our reservoirs and no energy in our gas tanks, no heat for our homes, how long do you think we will hold on to our precepts of freedom? How committed is the average man to any concept that does not feed his belly, clothe his body, warm his life? How committed is the average man to concepts? World history says, not at all. Shake his security as to what he eats, where he sleeps, what he wears, and then provide an answer for him in that midst, and he'll sign away his life to you. Now, the great thing to me of these past years, this may not be the final crisis, although I must be in all honesty to you, I must say things are adding up in a, it's like a daily adding scale for me as far as theology is concerned. I don't make rash statements and rash claims, but I must say that certain things are adding up that are irreversible. Certain environmental things are irreversible. Even if we all change tomorrow, we're not going to reverse them. Certain things politically are happening that are irreversible. And these things are stacking up daily. Almost every day brings a new set. For example, we now are told this is not every, I don't know whether you're reading the papers or not, every commentator I'm reading is saying, friends, this is not just an unusual weather year. You see. The Gulf Streams have changed. The air streams have changed. something very dramatic. And of course now, for example, as most of you know, things that we'd have laughed at. We'd have laughed out loud at a suggestion a few years ago that they go to the North Pole and cut away portions of icebergs and tow them into ports and find a way to get the water as it evaporates or as it melts. Now that would have been, we'd have thought that was absolutely insane. That's now a realistic proposal, my friend. Did you hear what our California congressman proposed today to the President of the United States? That a massive emergency pipeline be constructed from the east to the west to bring the snow runoffs into the reservoirs of California, and that perhaps the Alaskan pipeline be used for that purpose now that it's done, instead of being used for oil. Now all I'm saying is, with all of this happening, do you have ears? Are you hearing? And if nothing else, are you seeing how quickly these things happen? I remember Bible teachers years ago talking about Jerusalem being in the hands of the Jews. And I remember a debate I was in college. Now this is my lifetime, just a few years ago, friends, because I'm a very young man, as you know. And just a few years ago in college, I remember a man debating with a man on the subject of Bible prophecy. It was in one of our religious groups on campus, and they were debating, and this man was poo-pooing the fact. He said, no way will the Arabs ever give up Jerusalem. In fact, he said, it is 1,000 years away before the Jews would ever be able to make an arrangement to get Jerusalem. And you and I lived through a six-day period of time in which it happened. And I remember sitting, I didn't go to work, I didn't go anywhere. I sat there with my eyes glued on that television set for almost those 6 days, and most of you did the same thing. I could not believe my ears and my eyes, nor could the world, as little David with a slingshot brought down Goliath. Because don't forget, it was the Soviet Union that was behind what was going on in the Six-Day War. All I'm saying is, do you see how quickly these things happen? In the flashing of a moment, this state is brought to its knees by drought. The East is brought to its knees by cold. The world is brought to its economic knees by oil. And if God says nothing else to us, he's saying, my little children, see how passing, transient, shaky all of these things are. They are worth nothing. And I can only think, in fact, the Lord brings these words to my mind, I guess, once a day, the words of Peter when he said, seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of man ought you to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hastening on to the glorious appearing of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's the message. Now, in the midst of that, as you know, I'm a hopeless spiritual optimist, not a humanist optimist. I'm a hopeless spiritual optimist. I don't think the church is going to get weaker and weaker and hobble into eternity like a 70-year-old arthritic bride to meet Jesus Christ. I don't believe it, not for one moment. I believe the promises of Christ are going to be applied by the bride, and what I think is this is the most glorious day in which to be alive. What do your friends on your street have to have hope in tonight? Where is the hope of the world? It's gone. It's vanished. In states and governments and nations and powers and worlds and United Nations, where is the hope of the world? There is no hope of the world. What a marvelous day to speak from Hebrews chapter 12. Yet once again, signifieth the remaining of those things that cannot be shaken, those things that can be shaken, so that those things which cannot be shaken shall remain. Therefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us serve him with godly reverence and fear. What a fantastic day to bear witness to these eternal truths. All right, let's take a break. In fact, this will be the end at this point.
because we will not come back and, later. Yes, go ahead, Jewel.
I have a question.
Ow! Sorry, I've got a hamstring that's been pulled in my leg, and you hear some yelps when I bend. That's what it's all about. Go ahead, Jewel.
If you believe this woman, Revelation 12, is Israel,
yes.
Then that means Israel has to flee to the wilderness, right? Two times.
I think what it means is there, yes, that God will, in his divine mercy, protect the righteous of Israel during that period of 3.5 years. I think there will be a supernatural protection, yes. I personally, I was at Petra,
yeah.
And I believe, as do some Bible scholars, that there will be supernatural protection for Israel during that period of time. Now, that's not all of Israel. God makes a division 2 chapters ago, and he says, leave the outer court, don't even measure it. Because much of Israel is going to be involved in the deception, you see. But there is a spiritual, a seed out of her, a remnant, as has always been true of Israel, that is going to be protected and kept. Yes. Okay, anyone else? All right. The Lord just awakened in your heart the concepts of, whether... Let the Bible theologians argue over which are the 7 heads and which are the 3 horns or whatever else. But if you can get a picture that God is talking about the fact that there have been principles building in world power, human imperialism, human authority, human power, and that which has manifested itself prior in other kingdoms will culminate in a great humanistic imperial effort that will be, in a sense, a culmination of all that any kingdoms of powers and tyrannies have been in the past. And it will be given a supernatural religion at its heart. But it will fail. And Christ is the stone that is cast out that will destroy it. So then you begin to get a picture of how that all flows in the Bible. It's all just different pictures of various world kingdoms, all of which have had specific expressions. The animals picture. In fact, it's interesting that those animals named were the animals chosen by those countries in most instances. In fact, in all instances, the leopard and the bear. Bear being the Medo-Persian and leopard being Greece. And of course, the eagle was Rome, as you know. And the concept of iron, the feet of iron, the rule of iron. So what you have a picture then culminated in the Antichrist is that culmination of what the world has always known, and that is man's imperial efforts, man's tyranny. And it'll all culminate in the Antichrist. And he, of course, because of his supernatural power, will extend it like it has never been extended before, till nations, kings, and tribes will come under his influence. And of course, the economic power that he will wage will make that possible. But in the midst of it, of course, is his defeat. And it's interesting that the Bible specifically says that kingdom's only going to be for a day. In reference to other kingdoms, it's going to be the shortest lived. It's just going to spring up and seem very powerful. But its destruction is imminent. Okay, let's take that time now.
This concludes the message for tape number RH-264 of the Ways and Praise Tape Library by Rick Howard. Now please run your cassette at Fast Forward to the End so we'll be ready for the next user.